This is the TTY Dialer, Episode 9, for the week of December 19th through the 24th. Hi, I'm Mark Levonier, and this is your weekly companion to WRBO's old-time radio show tuned to yesterday. Every night of the week on the air and online, we bring you the golden age of radio. Comedy, mystery, drama, suspense, adventure, and much more. And lately, it's been a lot of Christmas broadcasts, so this podcast is designed to get you ready for the week of shows coming up. Also, have some fun with sound from radio's past and learn some radio history, bringing us even more context to these great shows that have survived the test of time. And speaking of which, the best time to listen to this is on Sundays or Mondays to set you up for the week. And I'll get to the first couple of nights of what we'll be airing in just a few moments.
Meantime, I want to answer a question which, judging by the number of inquiries, must be puzzling a lot of drivers today. It's this. Since certain gasoline ingredients have gone to war, aren't all of today's gasoline the same? No, indeed. If you've tried many brands in your car, you've already noticed a difference in performance. And I'll tell you why. Each oil company has its own refining method for its own brand of gasoline. Well, as thousands of Western drivers who keep a close record of their gasoline mileage know, the Signal refining method has for years been famous for its extra mileage. Signal is frank in telling you that with certain ingredients reserved for fighting planes, Signal can't promise all the brilliant performance you enjoyed with pre-war Signal gasoline, and which you'll again find in further improved Signal post-war gasoline. But the name Signal still stands for the finest quality gasoline that can be made. And Signal still places the emphasis on mileage. That's why with gasoline rationed, Signal Go Farther gasoline is more than ever your best buy today. If you haven't tried Signal Go Farther gasoline in your car, there never was a better reason or better time for getting acquainted with your neighborhood Signal gasoline dealer.
A wartime commercial taken from one of radio's most listened to mystery programs, The Whistler. Now, I know for you hardcore Whistler fans, that wasn't the announcer you're used to, Marvin Miller, but that was Murray Wagner, who was on the air in the later 1940s for a time. The show, The Whistler, featured tales of criminals mixed up in one scheme or another, with a narrator acting as sort of a Greek chorus, chiding the main character and their usually bad decisions to commit a crime or to cover one up. And the money behind the show came from the Signal Oil Company, who had gas stations up and down the West Coast and sponsored The Whistler for about 11 years solid, even when there was a split sponsorship a couple of times when the program extended to the East Coast. The company had sponsored radio shows as early as 1931, and starting in 1942, they would go on to sponsor the nearly 700 broadcasts of The Whistler, with, I'm sure, that contingent of listeners who would whistle along with the theme every show, with the woman who did it live on the air for nearly every broadcast, Dorothy Roberts. The signature theme was one that, according to its composer, Wilbur Hatch, only one in about 20 people could whistle accurately. All right, I can't help it. I gotta try.
How about flipping a coin?
Coward.
Fatty face.
Now, please don't quarrel over me. I know. We'll decide it this way. Whoever my finger points to last, my mother told me to take this one. It's you, Mr. Gildersleeve.
Shucks.
I get to carry the packages.
That Christmas shopping episode of The Great Gildersleeve heard this Monday night, December 19th at 10 o'clock, followed by Dark Fantasy from 1941. At 11 o'clock, more Christmas with Bing Crosby and the Kraft Music Hall, then Burns and Allen this Tuesday night on Tune to Yesterday at 10. It's the Red Skelton Show celebrating Christmas 1951, then Fibber McGee and Molly. Also in the 11 o'clock hour, Christmas Stocking 1944, and Suspense with the Story of Christmas for Carol. Enjoy these holiday shows this Monday and Tuesday evening from 10 to midnight on the air on Tune to Yesterday or online where we stream live at WRBO.org. This Sunday, December 18th, is the birthday of Hollywood radio reporter George Fisher, who, on the air during the 1940s and 50s, traveled the backlots, sets, offices, and homes of movie stars and produced an extensive series of brief interviews under the titles Hollywood Whispers and Hollywood Calling. And they weren't B-listers on that interview call sheet. He spoke with actors like Gary Cooper, Gale Storm, Ida Lupino, and Humphrey Bogart.
Bogie, at this point, I think it's a good time to ask you, how did you develop that famous but menacing smile of yours?
Well, I'll tell
this
you,
is
George,
a story,
the famous but menacing smile, I think, came about in this way. In the first place, I don't like to smile. I don't know why. So I guess it comes out as kind of a leer. I also have had a little accident with my upper lip. You can see the scar right here.
I see it.
And it paralyzed a little nerve, so when I smile, the upper lip doesn't smile with the rest of my face.
George Fisher was a trusted voice when it came to Hollywood news, and technically he was a gossip columnist for publications like the Los Angeles Evening News and Radio Mirror magazine. But he was a respected reporter with his stories of the cinema and had several regular 15-minute shows on the air in California and several syndicated series that were heard across the country. Shows like Let's Go Hollywood, Hollywood Confidential, and a series released in the late 1940s called George Fisher's Filmtown Featurette.
Here's a question that apparently interests every moviegoer. At least it seems that there's never a day goes by without my mail, including a sentence like this. Why don't the movie makers merely move their cameras to nearby parks, business districts, residential areas, places like that, instead of making carbon copy backgrounds and sets on the sound stages? It sounds like a practical idea, but believe me, it isn't. For instance, I went on location with director William Dieterle when Paramount was making Paid in Full. We went out to a residential street in the gracious White House, a house supposedly belonging to Eve Arden, one of the featured performers. It was a simple scene. Cameras were to focus on Lisbeth Scott as she drove up in her pretty red Austin convertible, stopped and chatted briefly with Eve. In other words, there were less than 200 words of dialogue scheduled. Now, here's what preparations were made beforehand. Arrangements had to be made for the stars to dress in an adjacent home. Of course, Paramount paid the owners of the homes for the use, and studio workers brightened up the front yards and planted extra shrubbery for the occasion. Then at 9 in the morning, the cast and crew arrived on the scene with me tagging hopefully along. Lisbeth Scott got into the car, drove up to the front of the White House, and leaned out to start her conversation with Miss Arden. Suddenly the sound man hollered, "Hold it, there's a plane coming." So, of course, everything stopped until the plane roared past and disappeared. Lisbeth turned around, went down the block, and started back. The camera started turning, and just as Liz pulled to a stop, the sound man cried out again, "Yes, it was the same plane circling the area once more and spoiling another take." The third time the scene was tried, Miss Scott and Eve Arden got almost halfway through their dialogue when the air was filled with some oh-so-familiar sounds, a wailing baby in a nearby home. So an assistant director started down a line of homes, punching doorbells until he found the home where the baby was crying. It didn't take more than another 10 minutes to get the infant quiet. You know, when I looked at my watch, it was 10:30, and I still hadn't seen anything that would be acceptable for the screen. Weary director Bill Dieterle called out, "Okay, let's go again." This time, when Liz Scott just got her mouth open to start the dialogue, the scene was interrupted by a shout. "Gosh, look, they're making movies right out on our street." The observation was made by an elderly lady just approaching the sound mic. She had just come out on her porch and gotten all excited. What did Dieterle do? Start the scene all over again, of course. Well, to make matters short, the next shot was spoiled by the yells of school kids who were just coming out to recess at a nearby school. Naturally, a break had to be called until after the kids returned to the classroom. Then a take was ruined by a dogfight. Finally, when my watch had turned past 12:30, Lisbeth Scott and Eve Arden managed to get through the entire scene without interruption. How long does the episode take on the screen? Exactly 34 seconds. And that's why so many movie scenes are duplicated inside studio lots instead of on location. It actually saves time and money. That's my Filmtown featurette.
Fisher's work on the air would end up earning him a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame for radio and other nods from the film industry, like the occasional movie appearance. And in a moment of serendipity for this episode, he made a guest appearance as himself in the television version of the radio show The Whistler.
What time is it?
7:05.
George Fisher's on the air. I just got a tip. He's supposed to have something about Mel Franklin's picture.
Well, how would he know before Gus or anybody?
Well, he's supposed to be an old buddy of Franklin's.
Let me see what he has to say.
First off, I can confirm those rumors that have been flying concerning a split-up between actress Sandra Laverne and producer Buzz Foster. Sandra starts a new picture to help her forget.
Just the usual junk about people breaking up.
And on the subject of new pictures, I promise to have something about the stars of Mel Franklin's next production. Mel has picked a newcomer this time for the leading role opposite the brilliant star of Vivian Marks. Needless to say, this newcomer should be around for a long, long time. When Mel Franklin picks them, they're usually nothing short of sensational. And so, Mr. and Mrs. Hollywood, here it is. The man who will play the lead in Mel Franklin's new picture is Robert Blake.
Not quite the news those radio listeners wanted to get. Hollywood's radio reporter George Fisher, born this Sunday, December 18th in 1909. And it's the big week of Christmas, and Tune to Yesterday is bringing you shows from the holidays from radio's past this Wednesday night, December 21st at 10 o'clock. It's the Bob Hope Show from 1948, then Dragnet with a great story called The 22 Rifle for Christmas. In the 11 o'clock hour, the Columbia Workshop brings us the charming tale, The Plot to Overthrow Christmas, then it's Suspense from 1959. This Thursday, December 22nd at 10 o'clock, it's Rogers of the Gazette from 1953 featuring Will Rogers Jr.
Even if you got a little money and your car isn't in a snowdrift, you can't tell about tomorrow, or the day after, or next week.
Yeah, only pretty soon it's going to be Christmas. I promised Francie we'd make it to Kansas City for Christmas. Her mother's there.
Oh, there's time. With a few breaks, you can still make it.
I guess I sound ungrateful, but I'm not. I don't know why we showed up at your office tonight, of all the places in town. But I'm glad we did. And I'll find some way of paying you back, Mr. Rogers.
You know, I'm not near as worried about that as you are.
And this Thursday night at 11 o'clock, it's Westerns for an hour for the holiday with Have Gun Will Travel from 1958, then a Western Christmas Carol on the Six Shooter starring Jimmy Stewart. You can hear these programs on Wednesday, December 21st and Thursday, December 22nd from 10 to midnight on Tune to Yesterday on the air or live online at WRVO.org. And by the way, if you're a listener who just likes to tune into the show and get surprised by what's coming up for that night, or if you use this podcast to help you plan for the week, you can always check out the schedule at your convenience right at our website, WRVO.org. There's a tab there called Broadcast Schedule. Just scroll down. We're right there, and we publish the schedule month to month. So you can really plan out your nights for old-time radio. A great way to do it, and it's all at WRVO.org. And on the subject of Christmas shows, you know, a lot of people feel differently about the holidays in terms of what they exactly want to hear. Some people play the radio and Christmas music in their car every time they get in it. Other people don't want to hear one song during the year. So what I've endeavored to do with this in mind is just broadcast about 2.5 weeks worth of Christmas shows. But you can always get your garden variety old-time radio programs on our second stream, WRVO2. There's information on how to listen at our website. It's basically Old Time Radio and Tune to Yesterday from 8 to 10 on that second streaming channel, which you can hear at WRVO.org. This Monday, December 19th in 1918, adventurer and storyteller Robert Ripley published his first column called Believe It or Not in the New York Globe. At the time, he was a paid cartoonist who usually handled the sports beat, but on this day, news in his department was kind of slow, so in addition to his normal sports stats with accompanying cartoons, he included a box dedicated to facts that belong really in the odds and ends bin. In just one panel, Ripley drew these stylized and dramatic depictions of strange myths and curious facts that he found through research and eventually through his travels across the world. In his panels were illustrated snapshots of freaks, intriguing statistics, and bits of knowledge that really had few forums outside of casual conversation. In just a few years, his column ended up being circulated in about 300 newspapers, reaching tens of millions of readers, and he used the money he made from that to fund his travels to investigate people's claims from across the world, everything from exotic flora and fauna to the average speed of rickshaws in certain countries. With his popularity, he started to build a robust staff to handle all of the tips that came in for him to pursue, which also freed him up for telling his stories off of the page and on the air. He made his debut in an interesting guest spot on the variety show The Collier Hour in 1930, and he had stirred the audience so much with some statistics that he posed that he would start a career on the air that would last nearly 20 years. His show, called Ripley's Believe It or Not, was a mix of stories and drama, romance even, and at times suspense, as he would broadcast remotely, among the first to regularly do so outside of the studio. One that had survived is where he swam with dolphins and a few sharks.
Down! Down below the water! Lower! Lower! Why, that's deeper than I thought it was going to be. This is very deep down here. Yes, down farther yet. Here it goes. Well, turn around, Jill. Well, I'm on the bottom, on the ocean floor, ladies and gentlemen. Now turn around, I see before me a fairyland. It's hard to believe that such beauty could be underneath the water. It's more beautiful under the water, really, than on top. I assure you.
Ripley's show also featured a lot of interviews with people who are part of extraordinary circumstances.
Tell us, Jack, what did you think when you were falling through the air to the ground?
Well, Bob, I realized if I pulled a ripcord of my emergency chute too soon, we'd get fouled up with the other one. Mm-hmm. So I waited till I got down about 800 feet, and then I pulled the ripcord.
Well, what happened then?
The emergency chute had been packed inside out, too. It just collapsed.
You mean it collapsed? Well, how much of the parachute actually did open?
Oh, it's just about the size of a beach umbrella.
Just the size of an umbrella. Well, I know that dead weight falls at the rate of about 120 miles an hour, and you must have been falling pretty fast when you hit the ground.
I don't know. All I know is I cracked some ribs and broke my leg in 12 places, and I was unconscious for 2 days.
Unconscious for 2 days? Well, did you ever make another jump after that?
Yeah, just to prove that I hadn't lost my nerve.
In 1940, Radio Guide magazine called his show consistently the most interesting and thrilling program on the air. And according to the ratings that I have for 1938, he was drawing up to 15 million people to their radios on Saturday nights at 8. And as a salute to Robert Ripley's column, making its debut this Monday, December 19th in 1918, here's a story from his January 24th, 1942 episode.
The time is June the 25th, 1876. Don Pedro was visiting the Philadelphia Centennial Exposition, and he had spent hours studying every single exhibit. And as our scene opens, we find his two guides, officers of the exposition, trying to persuade him that he had seen everything, and because of the heat of the day, suggesting that he draw his visit to a close. Don Pedro is speaking.
Well, gentlemen, it is most certainly an exciting day which you are showing me.
But I think now that we've covered just about everything of importance, Your Majesty.
Just a moment. There is something over here which I do not think I've seen.
Oh? Oh, that group. They're the inventors with schemes that will never amount to anything, Your Majesty.
Wait, that pale-faced young man who just coughed. Oh, I know him. He's the head of the Boston School for the Deaf. I'm very well acquainted with their work. Mr. Bell! Hello.
Oh, Your Majesty, I can't tell you how glad I am to see you.
And how is your school for the deaf coming along?
Oh, very fine, thanks. But I've taken this leave of absence to show another piece of my work here at the exhibition.
So? And how goes this end of your work?
Well, not very well, I'm afraid. I'm called an eccentric, and no one has even looked at my little invention.
Oh, really, Your Majesty? It's not even worth wasting your time with.
Can we return tomorrow when we're less tired?
Oh, tomorrow I go back to Boston, Your Majesty. This is the last chance I have of getting my invention recognized.
Very well, then. Tell me, Mr. Bell, what does it do, your machine? Can it bake bread?
No, but it can talk.
A machine that can talk? Well, that is indeed what you call spectacular.
Spectacular? It's ridiculous.
Well, let me show you, then. Now, I'm going through that door over there to a distance of about 500 feet. Now, in the meantime, Your Majesty, you hold this cup-like piece of metal to your ear and wait. Now, don't forget now. Hold it there until you hear my voice coming through it.
I will wait, my friend. Do not fear.
This is really an extravagant waste of time, Your Majesty.
Why, how can he hope to send a human voice over a wire?
And it's stifling hot in here.
If you please, I must have quiet. Otherwise, perhaps I miss the hearing of his voice when it comes through the little thing at my ear.
Hello?
Shh, I think it is now.
Your Majesty.
Oh, you hear, gentlemen. You hear. It speaks.
Listen now. Listen to my voice. To be or not to be? That is the question. Whether 'tis better to bear the slings and arrows. Wait now, Your Majesty. Wait just a moment, please, and I'll rejoin you.
Oh, yes, of course we will wait, Mr. Bell. You, gentlemen, can you not see the possibilities of this machine?
For
quoting Shakespeare, Your Majesty?
Ah.
Your Majesty.
Oh, but Mr. Bell returns. Hear what he will say.
Are you convinced now that it will work? And can you not see the advantage of having one of them in every household and having all of them connected up with each other? Think of it, Your Majesty. To talk to anyone you like, anywhere you like, without leaving your own home.
You're perfectly right, Mr. Bell. Gentlemen, has this not been explained to your satisfaction, too?
Well, I don't know.
Oh, but this is true, gentlemen. What Mr. Bell has said is very true, and you have wronged him. But now I wish to make a statement. I wish to speak about it to the press. I will tell the whole country that what Mr. Bell has said is true, and that everybody should listen to his little machine and think about what he has said. Indeed, gentlemen, the most amazing part of this whole amazing exhibition is that you have not in trouble yourself to listen to Mr. Bell before.
So it's to Emperor Dom Pedro II of Brazil, who became the first telephone subscriber, we can thank for starting the development of the commercial telephone. Believe it or not.
Years later, when Hollywood decided to make a movie called The Story of Alexander Graham Bell, they cast radio and film star Don Ameche to play Bell, and the movie was such a hit, for a number of years after it, people referred to the phone as the Ameche. Coming up this Friday, on Tune to Yesterday, December 23rd at 10 o'clock, we have repeats of some of the bigger broadcasts from Christmases past. Back-to-back episodes of the Lux Radio Theater with adaptations of the movies A Miracle on 34th Street and It's a Wonderful Life. The Saturday night, Christmas Eve at 10 o'clock, the definitive radio version of A Christmas Carol from the Campbell Playhouse. Then a command performance Christmas Eve special at 11. Hear these shows this Friday and Saturday night from 10 to midnight as you get ready for Christmas with Tune to Yesterday. And that's it for the coming weekend shows and radio history for this TTY Dialer podcast. I'm glad you're listening to it, and I know this is a busy time, but if you have a minute or two, send me an email. If you have any questions regarding old-time radio or this podcast, etc., I can answer them in the podcast itself or just to you directly. Let me know. Email Mark, M-A-R-K, at WRVO.org. I'm on the air this week from 10 to midnight, and I'll be back with another podcast on Sunday, although you'll probably want to listen to it the day after Christmas on Monday. Thanks for listening.